Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. 200 FBI agents and Nassau County police officers combined forces to form a dragnet, hunt for his kidnappers, and rescue him. Tesh lay handcuffed and chained to the walls of a closet in the Bronx with a medical bandage wrapped around his head to cover his eyes. His captors demanded that his wife, Janet, drop a bag with $750,000, the equivalent of $4 million in today's currency, in a locker at Penn Station, making the Jack Tesh ransom one of the highest in U.S. history at that time. FBI and Nassau County police detectives spent over a year before finally uncovering the meticulously planned kidnapping ploy hatched by radical mastermind Richard Warren Williams. The FBI internally dubbed the Jack Tesh kidnapping Operation Jacknap. The real-life crime drama that followed proved stranger than fiction, involving a tense across-the-country manhunt, a trailer in California stuffed with tens of thousands of ransom dollars hidden inside, a contentious jury trial that dominated New York City headlines for months, a guilty verdict that was overturned 21 years later on a controversial technicality, a retrial stymied by a mysterious fire that incinerated court records, and a civil verdict ruling that the kidnapper paid Jack Tesh back the ransom money plus interest. Operation Jacknap tells the incredible true crime story that continues even now. Indeed, as of this writing, no one knows where the majority of the ransom money is located. Inside, Tesh also details his offer of a reward to anyone helping track down the still-missing money and kidnappers. The book that we're featuring this evening is Operation Jacknap, a true story of kidnapping, extortion, ransom, and rescue, with my special guest, author Jack Tesh. Welcome to the program, and thank you very much for agreeing to this interview, Jack Tesh.
Thank you, Dan.
Good evening. Thank you very much for joining me and joining our audience. Let's go right to November 12, 1974. Tell us a little bit about where you're living at this time in Long Island. Just tell us a little bit about your background just before we talk about November 12, 1974.
Okay, Dan. Anyway, my wife, by the way, is sitting next to me. My wife Janet. At the time I was 34 years old. My wife was barely 30. We lived in the Kings Point section of the town of Great Neck. We lived a low-key life in a very modest house. We had two. At the time, two young children. One was six, and the other one was two years old. Our third wasn't even born yet. In a family business, I worked in a family business, manufacturing steel construction materials, and it was we had a nice life. Raise a modest life, very modest, raising our two children.
Tell us about November 12, 1974. You write, at around 6:40 p.m., you were driving your car home from work as usual, but it was unusual. Someone was following you, and then you arrived home in the driveway. What happened right after getting out of that car?
Yes, it was. It happened to be a very foggy, rainy rain evening, and I was driving home. And normally, we lived on a dead end street, and a dead end. The main road going to the house was a dead end peninsula, and our particular street was a dead end street. So it was very unusual to have any cars other than when I was driving. This particular night, there was a car right behind me, and I even said to myself, boy, this is unusual. And I pulled into my driveway. It was about a 45, 50-minute drive home from my office. I pulled into the driveway up to my garage. It was closed, and I normally left the car outside facing the garage. And I pulled into I pulled up to the garage, shut my lights off, and I looked up at the garage, and it was all lit up. And I said, what is that? I just shut my lights off, and I just checked my lights again. They were off. I looked behind me. There's a car right behind me. And I looked in the rearview mirror. I get out of the car. And on my left, on the driver's side, there's an individual with a ski mask, and a silver-colored pistol pointing at my head. On the right-hand side was another individual, taller, with a ski mask, and with a sawed-off shotgun pointed at me. At that moment, and they said, basically, you're coming with us, or we're going to blow your head off. For the moment, I thought, well, what do I do? Do I run, which I could have, to the back of my house where there's a woods, which I knew very well, and felt I could do that. And then in a split second, I said, well, if I do that, will they go in my house, which was
right
25 feet away? So I didn't. I didn't run. They led me with the gun to my head to their car, which was a small little Ford Mustang, and they pushed me in the back seat of the car.
Now, they told you to lay down. You didn't get to see anybody, and quickly they put something on your eyes so that you weren't able to see and told you to get down on the floor, and all you could smell was this gasoline can. So what did you do in terms of realizing that you were in this, you were kidnapped, you were abducted, but what did you first do in terms of trying to potentially help yourself later? What did you think to do?
Well, what they did was they said, we're going to rob you and let you go. So just calm down, relax. We're not going to keep you. And they put putty on each of my eyes. And then over the putty, they put a pair of glasses so I couldn't see anything. And yes, there was a gasoline pushed me down in the back, and it was a small Ford Mustang, tight in the back seat. They pushed me down, put handcuffs on, and they said, we're going to drive you to our area, rob you, and let you go. And I just tried to think about every little thing, the ride. There was a went over a bridge. There was a toll machine. The sounds. That we went over some hills. I just tried to remember to see if I could possibly remember the route they were taking. And I did. I remembered as much as I possibly could under the circumstances.
Now, back at the house, meanwhile, your wife, Janet, is just discovering your absence, and you were late, which was somewhat unusual. She wanted to go to movies with her friend, and so she put the kids to bed and came downstairs and saw your car. What did she do after realizing that you weren't around? Who did she call?
Well, the first call that she called was my office to find out what time I left. She got a hold of somebody to say what time did Jack leave? Where was his car? And she got that information, and then she called some friends of ours in a panic that my car was in the driveway and I was nowhere to be found. So a couple of our friends came over and searched around the house, searched in the garage, searched in the, as much of the wooded area as they could, just to think if I wandered off or was bleeding somewhere or laying down, and still nowhere to be found. She then called the local police. We lived in an area that had a small local police department. And she called the local police. They came over, and they really were no help at all to her, unfortunately. They kind of brushed it off as, well, you know, maybe he's out drinking, or maybe he went off with the next door neighbor. They kind of laughed the whole thing off. So she then called my family, my brother. I had two brothers, and in a panic, she didn't know what to do. She finally called. It was either late that night or very early the next morning. She finally called. We had a very close friend of the family who was an assistant district attorney in the Nassau County. And she called him and said, look, my husband's car is in the driveway. He didn't come home. He never called. And there's something terribly wrong. And the individual that she called, who ultimately became a Supreme Court judge, he was an ADA, assistant district attorney at the time, knew me from when I was a child, knew me since I was 4 years old. So he picked up a phone and called the chief of detectives of Nassau County and said, look, I know this. I know Jack since he's 4 years old. I know the family all my life. This is totally out of character for him, not to come home, not to call, and nowhere to be found. There's something terribly wrong. And that started the ball rolling. All the higher-ups, the chief of detectives, the deputy inspector, and a staff of people came over to the house. They set up tape recorders on the phones, on all our phones. In the old days, they were the big tape recorders. They called the FBI in, and that was the point where the investigation really started. Thank goodness my wife called. Then, because the first ransom call, there were three. The first ransom call came in that evening from the kidnappers, and luckily, it was all recorded, and they attempted to trace it, but they didn't stay on long enough to trace the call. From that point on, till I was released 7 days later, the FBI, there were two FBI agents, a male and a female, and a Nassau County detective sergeant that moved into the house and slept there. They were there 24/7 with my wife, and that's when the horror began.
You write this, and you segue back and forth between the two incredible scenes, between where you are held captive and your wife and your family are held captive to a great degree. Your son, your almost seven-year-old, was never comfortable with this, and no one could give him the answers that he needed to understand where his father was and where all these people were in their home. But meanwhile, your nightmare was just beginning. So you are taken from that car. Again, you're brought into a building. What happens? You talk about the search and the conversation you have with the keeper. Tell us about that.
Yeah. We drove for about 45, 50 minutes, give or take, as I mentioned before, over a bridge, up a hill. Finally, they stopped and they said, wait, we're going to take you out of the car and we're going to walk you into a building. And they took me out of the car. I was blindfolded, one on each side, holding my arms. And they told me that three steps, you walk up, then you walk another three steps up, and we're going to guide you into a room. And they guided me into a room. I was standing straight up, and the first thing they did was methodically search and take everything out of every pocket. I was wearing a suit and a raincoat. They went through every pocket in the raincoat, every pocket in the suit, took everything out, went through my wallet, went through all my identification, and that started questioning me, and they said, you know, we think we're not going to let you go so fast. We think we're going to keep you for a while. They then guided me over to a closet and pushed me into the closet onto the floor. It was probably 2 feet by 5 feet. And all of a sudden I heard the sounds of chains. And I said, what the heck could that be? They had chains which they looped through eyelets that they apparently had screwed into the wall on each side. On one side was my where my head and shoulders were. I couldn't lay down flat. I had to sort of half lay down. And they took that chain, put it around my neck with a lock. And then the other chain, they looped around my feet with a lock to an eyelet on the other end of the closet with a little bit of slack on each side so I could barely sort of sit up and kneel if I had to. And then they put a gag on my mouth, which I couldn't understand. They eventually took that off, later that evening or the next morning, I don't remember, but I did have a gag. And that, when they started questioning me, they had to take the gag off. And then the questioning started, the sessions. They spent hours questioning every possible thing they could possibly ask me about my life, my parents, my father, my mother wasn't alive then, my wife, my wife's family, my brother, my brother's two brothers, bank accounts, artwork, any possible thing of value they wanted to know. Everything about that, everything about the company, people that work for the company. And apparently they knew more than they let on. As the interrogations went on during the week, it was obvious they knew more, and they were making sure I was telling them the truth. They had answers to many of the questions before they asked the question, and that came out very obvious. So in the closet was a bucket to relieve myself. And that's where I was for, of the total of 7 days, about half the time I was chained in the closet with handcuffs. They never did take those handcuffs off. And the after about half the time, they took me out of the closet and put me on in the same room, a bed. And they took the same chains and chained the bed around the frame. So I was still chained, but I was in a bed.
Now, what kind of conversations was the captor having with you, other than these questions and narrowing it down? He wanted to know about the bank account, specifically about the company, Acme Steel Partition, that you were vice president of and your father had founded the company.
Yes.
He wanted to know those particulars, and he was asking you questions like if Janet was excitable and basically trying to find out and determine which person would be better to deal with in what you realize soon enough is a ransom and a kidnapping. So how do they prepare you, and what are some of the questions that they try to get from you, and then how do they prepare you for this ransom and to communicate with your wife in the chance of getting this ransom?
That's exactly, you're exactly right. They knew more than, of course, that they let on. I never knew until I was released at FBI headquarters in Manhattan how much they asked for and how much they got. They never let on. But they did know quite a bit about the company and quite a bit about my family, and they kept targeting in who was the person, whether it be my brother, my father, my wife, most likely to be able to get that money together and meet their demands. What I didn't mention is that these individuals were radicalized and blatantly anti-Semitic from the minute I came into that room to the minute I left. They preached, they raved, they ranted, they didn't stop with their rhetoric. Radicalized rhetoric we're the haves and they're the have-nots, and they're going to take what they want to take and get what they want to get, and they're going to do it.
Now, as well as this radical idea or radicalized idea that they were righting a wrong by saying things to you like, you guys shouldn't keep all the money, being Jewish people, that being, and that basically Jewish people and other people had built their fortunes on the backs of black people and poor people. That was part of the gist of what he was saying. How did they prepare you? We're talking about the tape recordings. Tell us how they prepared you and what they got you to say in those tape recordings that were going to be forwarded to your wife.
Well, they were very specific of what I should say, and there were at least two. First, they took a picture. They gave me a local newspaper, which had the date on it, and took a picture of me holding up the newspaper. Not my whole body, from the mid-waist up. Then they prepared me exactly what to say, very specifically what to say. Who should get the money together? They never told me the amount. Who should get the money together? Who should make the payoff? What should they be wearing? They shouldn't tell anybody, especially the police. And by the way, very, very important, the newspapers knew about it, knew about the abduction shortly after it happened. And
right.
the FBI and the police went to see them and said, please don't publicize this until we get the victim back. And in those days, they listened and they did it. And I could tell you that saved my life, because they had mm-hmm. that radio blasting in the other room, listening, and I'm sure they just couldn't figure out why it wasn't on the radio. The newspapers honored the request.
They asked you questions like how much money you had forwarded to the Jewish Defense League as well, just to demonstrate where their mindset was.
Yes. Yeah. I didn't even know what they were talking about, to be honest with you. But this rhetoric, the anti-Semitic rhetoric, pro-radicalized, was pretty much constant during the whole week, and the raving and the ranting and it didn't stop. I listened. What could I do? Nothing I could do, and I just prayed a lot. Only one. There were at least four involved. It could be more, but a minimum of four. Two in my driveway, and there were others in the other room. I heard walking and talking. But only one of them ever spoke to me. Or one other spoke, but only like one or two sentences. But only one was the one that talked to me, came in three, four, five times a day into the room I was in. And he was the keeper. We call him the keeper. He was the only one that spoke to me of any significance.
After all this intel that he gained from you, about your family, about business dealings, about virtually everything, you noticed that they were zeroing in on the bank accounts from your business. They asked you how many bank accounts you had at your company, and you told them it was a general one and another payroll one. And they said, how much money? And you said $50,000 in total. Now, he left and he didn't return for a long time. When he came back, what information did he have, and what was your explanation for something that made him very irate?
What happened was, when he came back, he said, you didn't tell me about the pension and profit sharing company accounts. And I said, I didn't mention it because that's not my money. It's not the company's money. It belongs to the employees. And I don't have access to that money to take. It doesn't belong to me. And he went into a tirade. And he obviously knew about the accounts. And he said, who signs the checks? I said, I'm one of the signatories on those checks. He says, so you do have access to the money. I said, yes, but it's not mine to take. And then he didn't question me any further on that, because he knew the answers to that question before he asked the question. So I couldn't. I told him what what it was.
Now, meanwhile, Janet has called the old friend, Jed Orenstein, the DA, and so gotten things straightened out. And the police, now that they took Janet to the bank and realized that you didn't take out any withdrawals, they're now believing that there's something to this. The kidnappers didn't call for 26 hours, and you say that it was a blessing because the recorders weren't set up at that time. And when Janet got the first call, you describe in the book this incredible exchange, because your wife is, again, a very, very strong person in your corner, but also she is shocked, and no one is prepared for this kind of pressure and tension. So after that phone call, what was said in that call, and then what was created after as a result of that phone call?
Well, the phone call came to the house, as I mentioned, and was recorded, and the FBI and police were there. They told Janet to try to keep him on, keep the individual on the phone as long as possible, but he was very clear. He said, "I have Jack. I have him, and unless you meet our demands, we're going to kill him." Basically, in so many words. And you have to listen, and we're going to get back to you with specific demands. She tried to keep him on the phone. She couldn't, and they couldn't trace the call. But that's when they knew I was alive. They knew it was a kidnapping, and that's when the all the police and the rest of the authorities got involved.
What did the keeper tell you about your family cooperating with police? What did he warn you about?
Well, only that that if the family didn't cooperate, he was going to kill the whole family, my wife, my brothers, the entire family. And they had better cooperate, or he was going to kill them all.
All right. Now, you have this incredible group of people assembled, FBI, Nassau County detectives, and now everybody's on board once they've got this call and they realize the magnitude of this case. And you say that these people that were put in your home for months, different people, but FBI agents, risen to the challenge, and also that they became close friends and helped your family survive this ordeal. Who are the people that the kidnappers suggested that they deal with? And so, who did they decide
the
out of your family that they would decide with?
Yeah, the kidnappers specifically wanted my brother out of the company, my brother and my family, my wife. Those are the only two they wanted to deal with, and they wanted them to deliver the ransom money in the place that they said they, which we can get into the payoff. But they're the only two they wanted to deal with. Now, having said that, my wife, there was a female agent at the house, and if my wife wasn't up to making the payoff, the female agent was going to go in her place. And they tested my wife to make sure that she was up to that challenge, and it was a pretty rough evening of testing, and she passed all the tests, and she insisted that she had to make the payoff. She didn't want anybody else to do it. They may know that it wasn't her, and she didn't want to take a chance on losing me on doing something that they told her to do.
Right. Part of the technology at that time, there's no cell phones. They equip your brother and your wife with two-way radios. We'll talk about what happens when they try to make this drop for the ransom money, what happens with that technology. But how else do they prepare your wife and your brother for this exchange of money?
Well, other than briefing them, you know, the kidnapping, there's no books or there's no technical manuals, FBI manuals on kidnapping, because it's a rare crime for starters. It's not that prevalent of a crime, and everyone is totally different. Every kidnapping, this is what they told me later. They said, we don't have a protocol because each one is different. And it's as the kidnapping evolves, we decide what the next step should be. So in my case, it was my brother who got the money together, and my wife, and they were wearing to a FBI equipment, radios in their ears and all that. But it didn't work underground. None of the police radios, none of the FBI radios, and none of their equipment actually worked in Penn Station, the busiest train station in the world. The technology wasn't advanced. Today, the radios do work underground. In 1974, they did not work underground. So there was no communication, unfortunately, between my wife, my brother, and the police and the FBI. And by the way, there were 450 FBI and police scattered throughout all of Penn Station and all of the surrounding streets all around that evening. And nobody can, not only could they not communicate with them, but the police couldn't communicate between each other. It was underground between the concrete and the steel. So that was something that was, and possibly they knew about it. I wouldn't be the least bit surprised if they knew the radios wouldn't work, and that's why they chose that location to do it.
What was your family told? Sorry, go ahead.
One of the theories of the police is that one of the four or more of these people were somehow, shape or form at one time affiliated with the police to know that. They didn't think the average person would even think about that.
Right. What was the instructions from the kidnappers regarding the money that was the ransom, $750,000? What were the instructions? And what did the police advise them to do? What eventually did your family do to counter what they had said?
Well, a couple of things. Number one, the amount of money they asked for was $750,000. Very specific. The majority of it was to be in $100 bills. And a very, very small amount of it was to be in smaller bills. But the bulk of it in $100 bills. They also, my family, discussed with the police. It was a crazy, insane sum of money to ask for. And they asked, should we negotiate with these kidnappers? This is a ludicrous, crazy sum of money. And the answer from the professionals were, if you can gather the money and pay it, don't negotiate. In everything we know so far about this case, we would not, if you can't come up with the money, that's another story, but if you can, don't negotiate. We'll get the kidnappers back. We'll catch them, and we'll and we'll get your money back. Well, but so there was no negotiation. The amount that they asked for was the amount that was ultimately paid them. They were very specific of where they should make the phone call, which was outside of on the street, outside of the initial phone call, outside of Penn Station in New York City, and told them where to go from there, what locker, track 17, there would be a bank of lockers, and go into a certain locker and take out a black bag. And I'm sorry, the initial bag, what was one of the, to backtrack, the one of the calls that came to the house was that take the money, go to the Exxon station around the corner from my brother's house. He lived in another town, and go into the large garbage pail that's there, and there's a black bag in there. That black bag is the bag you're to use to put the money in. So that was either the second or probably the third call. And they did. They took the bag. They took it to FBI headquarters. Then they took it to the bank, and they gathered all the money together and put the money in the bag. Now, the other thing, they were very specific. The money should not be new money. It should be old money. Well, the bank, on a one day's notice, where are they going to find $750,000 of old money? So it ended up being new money. And in consecutive numbered bills, no less. So what they had to do, what I'm told, is they laid out the money around the table, and a dozen FBI agents took each dollar, each $100 bill, each bill, and crumpled it up to look like old money, and then of course mixed up all the numbers. They recorded all the numbers. They knew exactly what the numbers were, but they mixed it up and mixed in the smaller bills and crumpled up the other bills. And then put it in the black bag for the payoff.
Now, with this payoff, there was elaborate instructions back and forth so that these kidnappers could elude escape in Penn Station. But also, they back and forth details about the drop, telling Buddy exactly what to do and where to put this in and what locker. What happens with this? There's a hitch. Tell us about this hitch.
Yeah. Well, they was very specific where to put the money. And they, my brother and my wife were together, and my brother put the money into a locker and inadvertently took the key with him. He wasn't supposed to take the key out of the locker. Took the key with the locker. They went to go find them, pick up the money, and they couldn't get into the locker. And there were calls back and forth, you know, landline calls back and forth with the kidnappers, and said, yelling at my brother that he's deceiving them and they're going to kill me and. What did he do? And there's no money and all this stuff. So then my wife went back and said, this was on the street, by the way, the payphone. They went back up to the street to make these phone calls. Then they went back into Penn Station at the track 17, my wife and my brother. And my wife realized, number one, he put the money in the wrong locker, not in the locker that he was supposed to put it in the locker above the one that he was supposed to put it in, and then took the key of the locker that he was supposed to put it in. So lo and behold, the money was sitting in an unlocked locker
Wow.
Above the locker that he was supposed to put it in, while they were outside calling. So my wife realized all this, and they then took the money out of the locker that it wasn't supposed to be in, put it in the locker that was supposed to be in, and left the key the way they were supposed to leave the key. And there was a duplicate of that same black bag that they brought the money in. There was a duplicate of it that they were to walk away with. Now, they ultimately did the right thing, and they walked away. The police, then the kidnapper, probably the keeper, went and collected the money. He was wearing a hat and glasses and a mustache and all that to disguise himself. The police have schematic, sketches, plenty of sketches of him. They tried to follow him. Now, remember, the radios didn't work underground. So they followed him as much as they could till he got on a subway, New York City transit subway, and they lost him. They couldn't communicate. Now, having said that, when I asked the person in charge, the inspector, I said, "Well, what happened? They said, "Jack, we could have grabbed them. That wasn't the plan. The plan was to get you back. The plan was not to grab the one kidnapper that we could have grabbed. The plan was to get you back safe, and we got you back safe." So they lost the kidnapper. Ultimately, I was released, thank goodness.
You were released, but the danger wasn't over. You described the incredible elation for you and your family and seeing Janet again for the first time. You filthy after a week. You had to be debriefed. It wasn't a process where you just went home. And then when you went home, there was this actual danger. What was the danger, and how did you and your family and the police and FBI respond?
You know, the danger was the constant threats. The police didn't know who these people were. Were they part of a bigger group? Were they from this country? From not this country? They didn't know. And the amount of threats and knowledge that they knew certainly frightened me, and to the extent that when I was picked up that evening, and I was driven to FBI headquarters in Manhattan on 69th Street, I didn't talk. I wasn't talking. I said, "Look, if I talk, my family isn't safe anymore." And I had no idea of the money, the amount, the payoff. I had no idea. But I just wasn't talking. And until they brought my family in, and I talked to my family, and I saw that they were safe, and found out a few of the particulars, and I spoke to the chief of detectives. I said, "Look," his name was Ed Curran. I said, "Ed," or Mr. Curran, I said, I'm not really going to talk unless I know that my family has full protection until these people are caught. We don't know who they are. The threats were to the extent that we're going to eliminate the entire family, and I can't live like that." So they then huddled, and they came back to me, and they said, "Jack, we assure you, you will get full protection, your family and yourself, until this case is resolved." And by the way, they lived up to it. they lived up to that. The police, they didn't know who these. They were part of a radical group or individuals, or they didn't know anything. It came, you know, during the investigation, way down, they were able to piece things together. But the police did give us, they gave the first month, we had the FBI and detectives around the clock at our house, if I left the house. And after the month, the FBI didn't supply anybody anymore, and the police came in, and the police assigned five permanent police in shifts, 24/7 shifts, for about a year, until things calmed down. So they were with us for a year.
Now, what are the? You talked about the police looking into trying to find these people, and they had no idea. The idea about the bank accounts, especially when you gave them information about the questioning from the keeper and these people, these kidnappers, but from the keeper specifically. So, what do police? Where do police look? Naturally,
apparently they knew about the company pension plan and the company profit-sharing plan. The company at the time was not a big company, but it didn't have any debt, didn't have any bank loans, and it did have a for a company that size, very good employee pension and profit-sharing plan. They had knowledge of those plans, so the first thing they did was interview anybody currently working for the company, and anybody that had worked for the company. There were hundreds. The company, I think, at that time had about 200 people, and I think they, from my recollection, they interviewed 400 or 500 going back 10 years, anybody that ever worked for the company or had a close affiliation with the company. And they tracked these people down and interviewed them. And actually, one individual that had worked for the company for 15 years in our engineering department had worked for us for 15 years, had left the company, and had gone to work, went on his own into some kind of a business. He didn't make it in that business, and he ended up working for a similar competitor of ours, a similar company located in New York also. And they went, they called him and interviewed him. The police, and the way they did it was one FBI agent, one county police went out as a team. They went and interviewed him the first time, and they just didn't like all of his answers. And they called him up and they said, his name was Charles Berkeley, and they said, "Charlie, we'd like to come interview you again. We some unanswered questions." So they went back a second time, interviewed him a second time, and they analyzed all his questions and his answers. And they called him again and said, "Charlie, you know, we need to talk to you again. Do you mind?" And they set up an appointment with him, and he never showed up, and he disappeared and left his family, four children, and they lived in Co-op City, wife and four children, and disappeared for, I believe it was at least 2 years.
The FBI also released a composite of the person that picked up the ransom with the fedora on. How useful was that, or helpful was that?
Well, he was the one that picked up the ransom with the fedora on was apparently the keeper that was the only one that really spoke to me, and the only one that I had contact, much contact. I had most 98% of the contact with. He was the one that was eventually caught, tried, and ended up getting 25 years to life. Richard Warren Williams was his name, and he was a childhood friend of Charles Berkeley, the one that worked for me that took off. They went to school together, elementary school together. They even went to they were both in Korea. By the way, Charles Berkeley was a paratrooper during the Korean War, and they went into the army together. These were very close friends, and they were both extremely intelligent, very well educated, very well spoken. And that was the connection. They were childhood friends.
You write about some of William's background. After he left your company, he had a checkered past in terms of success. Tell us a little bit about how his life evolved after leaving the company.
Yeah. No, Berkeley was the one that left the company. Williams actually never worked and didn't work for the company, but he did have a very checkered past. He ultimately was a very, very successful real estate broker in California, had his own brokerage company, had people working for him. He then became a pilot. And he went to one of the West African countries and ran a charter service. He was a pilot and ran a charter service. He actually taught college for a while out in California. Although he wasn't a full college graduate, he was able to he got a job teaching higher education. So he was very, very intelligent, had many, many jobs, and by the way, him being a pilot and owning a plane one time was actually the one piece that did him in, that they were able to start tracking him down through that. Although he lived in New York, he was living in California, and he was ultimately caught in California and brought back to New York for trial and sentencing.
When you talked about his background, too, he ended up at a real estate company, and he was doing really well. And part of the information that they had is that he began putting black militancy posters around the office, and it turned off customers and the staff itself. And he was even told, but very much like when he was in captivity, he said to that person, "I will do as I please. I am the boss." And you got a lot of that when you were in captivity, a lot of that same sentiment that I am the boss, you won't tell me. And that kind of attitude was the information that they got that sent his career into a downspin earlier on.
You're correct. The exact rhetoric that he professed while he was apparently a successful businessman, broker, was the identical rhetoric that he preached to me. Totally radicalized, totally power, the haves and the have-nots, the anti-Semitism came through very, very strong. And he was a smart guy that took the wrong road.
Mm-hmm. You talk about this incredible trial and how expensive, how the media treated this as well, how important this story became in the area and nationally and internationally as well. The trial itself, he went through a couple lawyers. At first, he said he wanted to defend himself. Then he settled on an attorney named Kane. And Kane, if you could describe it as a vigorous defense, to say the least, motions, as many motions as possible, delays and combative nature in court was characterized by his behavior in court. Talked about lengthy pretrial proceedings and then jury selection. And then finally, almost 3 years later, there is the trial, and you are to testify at that trial. Tell us about just a little bit about the trial itself and the hoopla surrounding it.
You know, the trial, you're correct. He went through several attorneys until he settled on this Donald Kane, who was known as a very, very aggressive lawyer. It was a 17-week trial, a lot of pretrial hearings, 45 witnesses. It was the longest trial in Nassau County. It was in state court, by the way. This was not federal court. And the reason it wasn't in federal court was that it didn't go across state lines. It stayed in New York State. So New York State tried the case. It was very, very contentious. Now, me as the victim, I was only allowed in the courtroom when I testified. And out of those 17 weeks, I only was brought in to testify, I believe, three or four occasions. And I was questioned by this Donald Kane, questioned by the prosecuting attorney, and cross-examined by Kane. It was not a very pleasant experience, to say the least. It was nerve-wracking to having to face him at that time, sitting in the courtroom. But the trial lasted all this time because of the contentiousness of both Williams, who carried on a lot himself. He was a jailhouse lawyer himself, and Kane. And it's amazing that the judge accepted a lot of it. There were things much that he wouldn't accept, but he accepted a lot more than I thought he would have or should have accepted. But the judge was very cool-headed. The witnesses were great. They brought witnesses in from California. They brought witnesses in from all over the place. And how can you dispute when you have $10,000 in a money belt on your person, which Williams had when he was caught, of the serial numbers of the money that was part of the ransom money? How could you get out of that? So
there was all kinds of solid evidence that Kane argued about. He argued for or asked for a mistrial 250 times. So I don't know if that's a record, but that is an incredible amount of times to be asking for a mistrial. And in fact, you were the last witness of Mr. Kane, the attorney Kane, in this hearings, weren't you?
I believe so. But that was I was up at least three times, you know, and my wife too. My wife, of course, was a witness also. But it was once, and then they called me back a second time, and then they called me back a third time. And those were the only times I mentioned I was even allowed in the courtroom.
Yeah. Now, the result of this trial after this incredible amount of time and all the histrionics that Attorney Kane exhibited at this trial, what was the verdict?
The verdict, kidnapping, extortion, guilty verdicts, and a 25 to life sentence. Now, a 25 to life sentence in New York State means you don't get out in 25 years. It means you first can apply for parole. And normally, you're never allowed out in 25 years. It could go 28, 30, 35 years. But in New York State, you got a 25 years to life.
The verdict, 25 years to life, how much did this settle you and your family? How much did this put things to rest? How much did this heal this, what you would realize later as PTSD? How much did this do to settle your entire family after this verdict and this lengthy ordeal of a trial?
Dan, that's a very good question. You know, not much, because we knew there were at least three others out there. They got the main guy, but there's no question there were three others that they didn't get, and not because they didn't try. It's very hard. So it was a little bit of solace, but not really a whole lot, to be honest.
You talk about in April 1980, a couple years after this July 12th sentencing, 1978, Charles Berkeley turns himself in. He's been missing since 1976. What happens with this effort to try to bring him to justice?
Very good question. And it was 4 years, now that you mentioned that. I said 2 years before, a mistake. He took off for 4 years while his buddy went to prison for 25 years to life. What happened was, as the story goes, he went to a reporter. He missed his family. And he said, he went to a reporter. He said, "Look, I'm going to turn myself in. I miss my family." And he did turn himself in. And the reporter walked him into either FBI or police headquarters. And he was already indicted. So he was for the same crime that Williams was. So the district attorney that handled the case called him in. I guess he was out on bail. Called him in and said, "Look, Charlie, we are prepared to offer you full immunity if you tell us you came back, you miss your family, you're going to go through a trial like your friend Williams went through. We're going to offer you full immunity if you tell us everything, from the beginning." What did Berkeley do? He's sitting in the district attorney's office. He gets up. He said, "I don't know what you're talking about," and he walked out. This is the arrogance of these individuals. And by the way, Williams was also offered during the course to a leniency and all of that if he would tell the whole story. Same thing. He wouldn't say a word. Now, having said that, with Berkeley, and he was indicted for the same similar crime, you know, indictment that Williams had,
mm-hmm.
and he and hired a lawyer, and the it was over. The indictment was overturned. It was overturned, and he walked out a free man.
Yes, 1996.
Yep.
It was based on back again on the judge did an admirable job, but Cain was again an effective and aggressive attorney, like you say, and then they went back in the appeal and said that there was a contentious issue over eliminating three black jurors, or the DA was asked to prove that they didn't racially profile three black
right.
jurors when there was a jury selection.
Right. Well, this was, now we're talking about Williams. Yeah, what happened was this was a federal law, and the law originally was that any prosecuting attorney or any defense attorney, when selecting a jury, they were allowed X number of peremptory challenges. In other words, if a juror, they brought a juror up there, and either the prosecuting attorney or the defense attorney didn't like that juror for any reason whatsoever. Black, he had purple hair, he had earrings, whatever. And they said, "Look, we don't want him." You didn't have to give a reason, and you could knock the juror out. They got each side got X number. Federal law.
Right.
The federal government changed the law in the 90s, where it said if you want to challenge, if you want to knock out a juror, you had to have, number one, a very good valid reason. You had to tell the reason to the judge, and the judge ruled on whether it was a valid reason or not. So, and it was retroactive. And retroactive mean that prisoners, not only Richard Williams, there were dozens, many, many others that were entitled to a new trial because of the law. And there were black jurors that were knocked out of the jury pool. District attorney had as much many notes 21 years later that he salvaged, and they accepted most of what he said. Apparently, there was one juror that his notes were not that clear on, and why he was knocked out, and that led to the reversal of the trial of the indictment of the sentence.
Interesting. In practical terms, you talk about filing a civil suit against Williams, and you also talk about that he was a great, you talked about he was very bright, and you noticed that right away, that he became an effective jailhouse lawyer while he was in there filing lawsuits against the prisons that he was in for certain things. But let's talk about the civil suit against Williams. What did you believed you could gain from it, and what did you gain from it?
Well, the civil suit it was brought in federal court, not state court, and we sued him in civilly for recovery of the $750,000. I brought him into. By this time, I was seething mad. Brought him into civil court on at least three occasions for depositions. The depositions were 2-hour depositions, at least, maybe longer. I ultimately got a civil award in civil court for the $750,000 plus interest for all those years. So the award ended up to $2.2 million or some number similar to that. And I went, knowing Williams, and the authorities always felt that Williams got the bulk of the money, number one, and that with his real estate, successful real estate background, that he invested the money. And so we tried to search as much as we can, and I spent money trying to find, to search records, and we couldn't find anything. Now, that doesn't mean it's not out there. It means that he was smart enough to, he had a brother living in the Virgin Islands, he had a couple of, he had four children, he had wives, I mean, who knows where the money was invested, under whose name, and where it is. We just couldn't find it, and the authorities believe it's out there, and that's one of the reasons I offered in the book. I offered a reward for information, to return of some of the money, plus or information on the kidnappers that were not brought to justice. I offered the $50,000 reward in the book, and not only that, if any of the money is collected, I'm not even keeping it. I'm donating it to the Federal Law Enforcement Foundation, which is a very fine organization, taking care of federal and local police in time of need. I think they did a superb job. They were compassionate. They were smart. They were tenacious, and they did what they could. And I hold no regrets to them. But it's out there. We strongly feel it's out there. And we just have to, and I still have this judgment, an act of judgment.
Mm-hmm. You talk about that it looks like my calculations, about $38,000 was recovered from the house and then the wheel wells of the vehicle. I could be wrong on that. But there's certainly a lot of money that is left unfound. You got to talk at the civil trial. You got to say something at the civil trial to Williams. What was the gist of what you had to say, and how did it feel to get that off your chest?
Yeah, well, you know, I got to say what they call, a victim's impact statement. Mm-hmm. And I got up and I wrote this thing out myself, and I said, "Boy, I'm going to just let him have it." And basically, what I said was, "You terrorized my family. You terrorized me for those days. And I am going to go after you. You, every member of your family, your children, your wives." And we're going to find that money, and we're going to and Williams, if you die, I'm going to go after your estate, and we're going to find it, and we're going to get it. You're not going to get away with this. So basically, that's what I told them, and I mean, obviously, it was a lot longer than that, but that was the gist. Was I got my payback, and there's nothing that he can do now to me, and he terrorized myself and my family enough. Mm-hmm. And if the money's out there, we will find it. And by the way, the reason we decided to offer the reward now, and it's in the book. We offered a reward in the book early on. For information leading to we didn't know it was Williams. And lo and behold, who notifies the police that they think they have some information? Williams's brother, Rudy Williams.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Rudy Williams comes notifies the police that he has some information that the police may be interested in. And he was this Rudy Williams was a thief in his own right. And he did meet with the police a few times. He did give them some information, not a whole lot, but enough that that it probably helped. And then he came after the reward money. So this is his own brother. What was I going to say? And lo and behold, Rudy Williams and his 14-year-old son shortly after were shot execution style in their basement of their house, also in Westchester County. So that's what happened to Rudy Williams. And the crime has never really been solved, 100% solved. He was into gambling and could very well have been part of his thievery over the years, not connected to the kidnapping. But anyway, he was shot. He was killed.
Yeah, incredible.
So,
in this book, you write quite a bit about, and we didn't really get into it because it would be much, much longer interview, but about your horror in your 1 week stay in captivity, not knowing whether they were going to kill you, because at first they said they were going to just rob you and let you go, and then you finally said, well, why didn't you just rob me in the driveway? So you had your suspicions, and for good reason, that you thought, they're just going to kill me. They're going to kill me. You talk about in this book throughout how you survived, how your family survived, and you give credit to those people. Tell us, as you write in the book, who you give great credit to in this for your survival and how things turned out favorably.
Well, firstly, my wife. I mean, she had with two little children to raise. She was incredible, strong woman, 30-year-old. I mean, she was a kid. She was. I mean, we were all young. She was incredible. The police were incredible. They held my family together. My brother was incredible. By the way, he was the original target. We didn't get to talk to that, but they tried to get him twice, on two separate occasions, not knowing that it was a prelude to a kidnapping, but on two separate, about 3 months, 3-4 months before they got me, they tried to get him. And both instances were foiled. He suspected something. He didn't know it was a kidnapping. He suspected they tried to lure him on two different occasions to lure him once to go come to the Westchester County Airport, and once go back to our factory in Brooklyn on a Sunday night in the rain. And he just felt it was something didn't sit right. The story the lure story just didn't sit right with him, and he didn't fall for it, luckily. And about 3 months after that, they came after me.
Yeah, and in retrospect, he realized what that was, but not until the kidnapping and afterwards, and then realized.
You know, at the airport, they tried to lure him at the airport. So he suspected something was wrong. It was a small private airport. And he brought his wife, my son, who was sleeping at his house for the weekend, and he had a big dog. And instead of going alone, he went, all four of them went together. And they must have gotten scared, the kidnappers, and said, look, what are we going to do? You know, we have and they took, they must have taken off, and there was nobody there, obviously, and that was one time. And he realized, didn't know it was a kidnapping. He said, this whole thing smells bad. I don't know what it is, but it just doesn't sit right.
Yeah. You had your own suspicions that night in November 1974 when you thought it was unusual for somebody to be following you as well. And then when they engaged in conversation, and again, you had that split moment. Am I going to run? But you decided not because it might endanger your family. You, in this book, Operation Jackknap, capture every excruciating moment that you are in captivity, held in the dark, a bucket to relieve yourself, and just horrible, horrible conditions that you endured, not knowing what would happen to you, what would be your fate. And meanwhile, your brave wife and your two sons didn't know either. So it's an incredible tale as you segue back and forth between your captivity and a captivity of sorts with your family, with FBI and police handlers in the home. I want to thank you very much, Jack Tesh, for coming on and talking about Operation Jackknap, a true story of kidnapping, extortion, ransom, and rescue. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dave.
I know this book is available on Amazon everywhere. I urge people to go.
Amazon, Barnes & Noble, all of the booksellers. It came out June 2nd, so actually this month.
Yes.
Doing very well. And the reward is very clearly listed in the book.
Yes,
absolutely. As well.
Yes, still out there. The money's out there, and the reward for any information for that money, its return, is there. Thank you very much, Jack Tesh. It's been a delight. Operation Jackknap, a true story of kidnapping, extortion, ransom, and rescue. Thank you very much, Jack Tesh. Good night.
Good night.